warm welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of today, you all. We finished the book. Today's section is pages 916 to 981 in the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text published by Little Brown and Company. This episode is going to move very quickly today, so hold on to your hats and get your bootstraps ready. Thank you all first to my patrons. You guys are awesome. I just wanted to give you a shout out. Finishing this book is because of my audience. I would not have read this book alone, by the way, so thank you to my patrons first and foremost, and then my audience proper as well. You guys are OG. You guys are cream of the crop. So we start here out with Gately, and we realize he gets into burglaring after he goes to prison. And after that whole fiasco, he becomes to get more and more adverse to violence. So he's really not working for Sorkin in the capacity that he has been as much, and he's going more into burglaring and being a burglar. Bobby C is the person that's slowly replacing Gately. He has purple hair, he's a hard drugs addict, and he's pretty cruel. We'll see more of him later. And we hear that Fackelman, or Fax, is stealing money from Sorkin based on this huge betting scheme. More on that in a minute. And Gately and Kite, where the memory starts is when Gately remembers that he and Kite found $22,000 and they split it. And so Gately gives his half to Sorkin, which I think says a lot about his character, because he's not going and buying $11,000 worth of drugs with it. He's giving it back to his boss, who he really likes and who put him out on bail as well. Now we are in the hospital. We have post-surgery Gately, the MD, a new MD, by the way, and a hot RN, the one with the syringe from last time. They're both there, and they're assembling this sort of headgear thing on the bed next to him, and there's this sort of palpable sexual tension that Gately is focusing on, and I think that's a red herring. Because in my reflection, I really, really do think that they're preparing for Otis P. Lord, or they're getting some sort of, like, apparatus ready, because we find out at the end of this novel that Otis P. Lord was the patient next to Gately, and so maybe this is an apparatus to, like, take the TV off his head. Who knows? Reflection as well here, that the total loss of control of his, even his bowel movements, guys, his voice especially, that turns Gately himself into a figurant, which just adds layers and layers to our discussion of the relationship between Hal and Jim. We also meet Pamela Hoffman Jeep, a little late in the book to be introducing new characters, but this is going to happen all the way up until the last page, basically. Pamela Hoffman Jeep is an alcoholic. She is very kitten-like, so her routine is that she drinks all day until she passes out, and then she calls anyone who doesn't do bad things with her a gentleman, and so she becomes Gately's girlfriend because he doesn't want to take advantage of her, which is, yeah, really low standards, by the way. Please think about your actions if you're finding someone else, you know, that's similar. Pamela Hoffman Jeep is also the one that catches Fax in his scheme, which is really interesting because it means that Fax pretty much has not been thinking about the ramifications of all of this yet. And he's not doing great in that secrecy regard. So the scenario of Fackelman's deceit of Sorkin is that there's this guy named 80s Bill who makes a lot of bets with Fackelman, and Fackelman always has to call in and say, hey, is this bet okay? There's a lot of money involved. And 80s Bill never votes against his alma mater, Yale, but he wants to do that with this particular game because he's gotten some info. We're not going to go in the situation because of child stuff, child protection stuff. And so there's a situation that 80s Bill knows about, and he wants to bet against his alma mater here. And so Fax calls Sorkin's assistant, and the assistant mixes up the teams. She thinks that 80s Bill is wanting to vote for Yale, and she knows, based on outside information, in fact the same information that 80s Bill has, that Yale is likely to lose in this game. However, so she approves the deal. However, what happens is that by a miracle, Yale ends up winning. So Fax wins the bet and all the money, but Sorkin thinks that he lost the bet. So Fax basically takes 80s Bill's money and Sorkin's money and just sort of like doesn't tell either of them. However, there's this guy named 60s Bob who is 80s Bill's dad. And 60s Bob is also Sorkin's trusted doctor. So Sorkin is bound to find out whether it's from 60s Bob or from C, who has the same drug dealer as Fax. And, you know, he's bound to hear about the mountain of drugs that Fax just bought with all his money. So basically, Fax is in total denial, and he does drugs to get out of that denial, as Gately so poignantly points out. So he starts just sitting in the corner and doing his mountain of drugs, waiting things out, and Gately joins him. So it's a really interesting scene, and this is the starting point of the longer narrative that we're going to revisit over and over near the end of the novel here. On 9:33, there's a really interesting tense shift that happens, and we're back at the hospital, and Lyle is licking Gately's forehead in Wraith form. And I love this little tidbit. I think that it adds a lot to Lyle. It adds a lot to Lyle and Jim's relationship as well. And we'll talk more about Jim's and the Wraith's influence on the novel in a minute, but yeah, this is just a little tidbit that, you know, you guys know, I'm a sucker for Lyle. I love him. I want to be him for Halloween. Can we make that happen? Has that ever happened? Let me know in the comments if you want me to be Lyle for Halloween, and I will do it. All right, next thread here. We only get little paragraphs, like little droplets from Joelle for the rest of the novel. I'm a little disappointed about it, but you guys know I also love these little threads, so I'm on the fence about it. All right, so Joelle Van Dyne is, you know, exiting the hospital, and she is grabbed by this big lady who says she's in grave danger. And Joelle Van Dyne has the funniest response. I don't remember it verbatim, but it's something like, yeah, what's new? And that's all we get from her. And the next little thread that we get from is Gately and Fax's binge, and so it's interesting because this binge and the hospital are paralleled. We know that Gately has a pretty bad infection, they're trying to treat it without giving him narcotics, which is hard, and so Gately, when he's in the binge, back in the luxury apartment, he passes out on the floor, and there's this teepee on the wall with flames still showing on it, and it falls off the wall, kind of in tandem with Gately in some ways. Alright, so next thread here, Joelle Van Dyne, back to her, where she's being interviewed about her role in Infinite Jest, and so we hear that she's only in two scenes in the whole thing, from what she knows. There's a crib's eye view of her, and she's talking about presumably the mother stuff and the death stuff. And there's also a scene where she's walking through a revolving door and she recognizes someone. Neither of these are new, by the way. We've heard about both of these in pretty interesting detail throughout the novel, so neither of these were a surprise. I think that this is just a really great section to put them together in, to remind us of, so here we have them. And we learn that Infinite Jest, which we already know, is supposedly buried with himself, the Master, that is. So you can't make copies without the Master. That's what the AFR is after here. And one interesting tidbit that Joelle is talking about for the whole interview is that Infinite Jest was a joke to her and himself, which is really strange. It's like, it's almost like her veil, how she made a joke of her veil a lot of the time. But I think that both of these symbols in the novel, Infinite Jest and her veil, are hidden truths in some way. And I find that really beautiful, that there are these parallels between these two characters that we've gotten to know really well over the course of the novel. All right, so Hal, in this next thread here, finds Mario and Coyle, who is Stice's roommate, watching a movie called Accomplice with a C-E, exclamation point, in Hal and Mario's room, page 941. I love this quote. The sky looked diseased. And the sky is, of course, diseased-looking because of the incoming storm. So we get the background behind what happens to Stice as Hal is basically, like, sitting out of commission in the viewing room. So Trolch apparently ripped Stice off of the window, which is why half of his face is left on the window. And then Kenkel wraps his face in toilet paper. And so Stice, like, disappears into the room, locks his door, which is why Coil is locked out. And we hear that Trolch switched with Axford. That's why Trolch was in Axford's room. And we also hear this fact that Stice's bed, when they woke up, was bolted to the ceiling overnight. So this is a pretty extreme thing because, you know, there's the cans in front of the door and on the window. You know, nothing's getting in there to do this for Stice. So it's a big move. And, here, Hal is showing emotions again. We had that scene with Kenkel last time. Mario says that Hal looks sad. Maybe, I think Hal is pretty sad, but maybe he doesn't want to show it. And also, Stice is pretty mentally messed up at this point because of the whole ghost thing. Now this face thing is just the icing on the cake. Page 944, we have a quote, "What if it's the mental buckling that's raised his Stice's game?" Coyle said. Does it still count as buckling? This is what I've wondered so often with Hal in this book, and I thought it was a really poignant quote to point out here. And so here's the thing. Here's my, like, big spoiler for this section and the dealing with the wraiths. So Stice in the manuscript apparently was, like, nicknamed the Wraithster. And so there seems to be a connection with Stice and himself. And so himself, my guess is, because wraiths can't move physical objects, my guess is that himself is the one that is influencing Stice to move his own bed at night, and also to move things around ETA, and to put, like, the tripod in the forest, and, like, all these things around ETA. And then also maybe is this thing with Hal and how Hal is, like, super disassociative right now and he's starting to show emotions again. He's very much not himself. That could potentially be because Pemulus's stash of DMZ is missing, that Madam Psychosis drug, and possibly Stice could have loaded Hal's toothbrush with the DMZ that's missing. So it would have been Stice that, like, set up the whole thing. Again, this is my, like, speculation. I have read a couple of, like, posts and things. There's one very famous one by this guy named Schwartz that's linked in the description. I would definitely read that if you're interested. It's very interesting. So yeah, there's a lot of, like, loose ends that you sort of have to bunch together at the end of this novel, but that's my theory about how himself is getting things to move. Is he sort of convincing people of things? Especially Stice. And there's a lot more that is inferred in the Schwartz blog about Stice and how Hal is eventually, in a year's time from this thread, going to play Stice at the Whataburger, and he's essentially, like, meeting himself in that regard. So it's very interesting, but I will leave those kinds of speculations up to you guys. The plot of Accomplice I'm not going to talk about because, again, this kid thing, it's a little too graphic. Then Hal is watching the news about the snowstorm and this, like, record snowstorm since it's the biggest one since BS98. We get a little bit about himself and about Avril here as well. So himself was a serially engaged person. Once he sort of mastered something, he moved on to another thing. And so they saw this with the Tennis Academy, with film, with a lot of annulation and everything like that. Hal was the same way as a child, and it seems like ever since he was a child, he's just been diverging away from himself in some ways. They don't understand each other, that's very clear to me. And Hal starts remembering some tableaus about his childhood. A lot of them, though, are likely not true, just because they have little bits of truth, maybe, but the memories seem flawed somehow. And Hal points that out himself as well. He also is commenting on watching Avril age over the years, which is a very, very interesting thing. I mean, I know people think about this, right? I've thought about this once or twice, where you sort of don't notice it day to day, but you do notice it over a period of years, and this is what Hal is reflecting on with his mom. So page 951, a quote, "I accepted it. I could not remember." This is Hal speaking, and this is a huge shift in Hal's point of view. It's interesting to me, this shift, because Hal, you know, is such a genius. He's, you know, perfect recall, all of that. And he has this disassociation and this detachment that we haven't seen from him before, which I think is really crucial towards the ending of this novel. And of course, the ending continues on through the beginning of the novel. So if we were smart, we would read, like, the ending of the novel and then the first, like, 50 or 100 pages or something, because the time is just so fluid. This book really is an infinite loop of text, you know, because you could finish the novel, then go back to the beginning, and it's just continuing on. So it's very, yeah, it is infinite in that way as well. It's also hard for Hal to reconcile early memories of himself and works like Accomplice, because he remembers himself as, like, all legs, you know, stirring drinks, and then the plot of Accomplice is so, raw? I don't know how else to say it. It's so dirty and so different than his memories that it's just really hard for Hal to conceptualize. And this is sort of his moment for me where I was like, oh, they just really don't understand each other. My question also, is this his second exposure to DMZ? Because Hal relates the mold story again. And I think that clue is really important to us in this thread, as Hal's thinking and he's sort of on this weird trip thing. So when he ate mold as a child, is it possible that DMZ, like, was involved in that? Did himself create DMZ to sort of solve Hal and after he ate the mold and his problems after that? That's all up to speculation as well, and I think there's a lot that we could talk about with this DMZ thing, but I want you guys to be critical with the text yourselves and sort of delve into the DMZ problem. My personal opinion about it is that this is his second exposure to DMZ, and that he's sort of encountered it before, and that it's had different effects both times, but you guys can be the judge of the truth of that. Hal also contemplates injuring himself, which we know doesn't happen because the beginning starts in the future, based on where this narrative thread is taking place, so we know that that never happens, and it's really, really useful to start remembering the beginning here, to go back to your notes if you have them, even to reread a couple pages. That's super enlightening oftentimes, especially as we get into this part of the novel. And also, you could never lie to himself. I love this little tidbit from Hal, because we know that his whole, like, office space is blue, and I think that's sort of like a physical manifestation of the fact that you just can't lie to him. Alright, so we've got the most intimate himself moment when he caught Oren trying to view an X-rated cartridge after hours. This was before ETA was so disciplinarian, so Oren knew that he could probably get away with it. But himself basically says, look, as a, like, headmaster, I could say, go ahead, watch the film, it doesn't matter to me. But as your father, I don't want you to have that objectified view of sex. And that was something that's really interesting, and I think we don't get a lot between Oren and himself in this novel. And so this is a moment where I really took, and I have some views about Oren that I'm going to share later, and this is a view that I took and thought, this is something that we can work with. And Hal never had that when he was a kid, and, you know, himself died when Hal was really young, relatively young. And so Hal never had that moment with himself, and, you know, he doesn't really know about Mario's involvement and whether he was intimate with himself, but, Hal never had that, and that's a big moment. That was a big moment for me in this narrative when I thought, oh, actually, their relationship is terrible and worse than I thought. As well, Hal thinks over Avril's promiscuity, another big hint at the end of this novel. He knows that she's involved with Wayne and others, and he's disinterested. At least he seems disinterested to me in that fact. Next thread, Joelle Van Dyne, the OG. It's after the AFR's interrogation of her, and she's going back to Ennett House through the blizzard on the T. Well done, Joelle. Next thread, there's an AA meeting, and it's just like an excerpt from it, as we've seen in the past. Probably 75% or so the way through the novel, we had a couple of these. And there's an alcoholic, his name is Mikey, and he needs consent from his sister and his mother to see his kid. So he's early on in his journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he scares himself because he reminds his new self of his old self. And this is a theme, you know, this like new self, old self thing, or this rebirth thing. This is a huge theme in this entire novel, right? Half of it is about Gately and other drug addicts, people who have two separate selves. And the other half is about, you know, this sort of like rebirth DMZ, Madame Psychosis, Jim and Condenza as first as a person and then as someone who's dead, then as a wraith. You know, it's all about rebirth and it's about Hal's journey through figuring out, okay, emotions versus thoughts versus him being a spectacular, you know, academic or something. So it's a lot about rebirth, huge theme here. And that's what I got out of this little thread here, is that it's just sort of another contribution to this very overt theme. Next thread. The district attorney, the ADA, is visiting Pat here. I've got a quote from 961. Quote, "Then back home in her own house, she was a shattered husk of a wreck." This is talking about Pat. I thought this was really interesting insight into Pat. I really like Pat's character. It probably like second or third to Kyle or to Lyle, honestly. Kyle, where did I get that from? I think second or third to Lyle. I just really like Pat. I think she's a stand-up gal, and she's really she sticks to her guns, and I really like that about her. So she protects her staffers and her patients with all she can, and then she is a wreck when she gets home. Quote on 962, quote, "Frankly gave Pat the howlers," unquote. I don't know why we've transitioned to howlers at this point. That's something I want to look at in one of our after episodes. By the way, if you want to know what our after episodes are, our patrons already know. So if you're on Patreon, you already know what we're going to do for the month of September. If not, you're going to have to wait for every week to see which subjects we're covering on this book after the end. So I realized this big thing. I don't know if I realized it late or not. I was just reading along and I got hit with a realization that the ADA is the guy that Gately robbed and sent a. Basically, he took a picture of someone's toothbrush up his butt and he sent that in the mail to the ADA. I think this guy was the one that sent him to prison or something, so he wanted to get back at him. And so the ADA's wife, her name is Tootie, and she is a serial teeth brusher now, and she like has bleeding gums. Everything is pale and there's no circulation because she just brushes her teeth too much. And this guy has an addictive attachment to his wife now, and stopping his wife from doing this and like letting her go and do what she needs to do. And so yeah, so that's the whole situation there. And the ADA needs to forgive Gately as part of his own journey with forgiving and letting go and getting this addiction solved. And he is the man with the hat in the hospital that Gately thinks is trying to indict him. Little did we know until now that yeah, this thread is being wrapped up rather nicely. Next, page 964, 20th of November, YDAU immediately pre-fundraiser exhibition Fete, Gaudeamus igitur. All right, so the ETA pals, all the tennis kids, are getting ready for this fundraiser, which has been outsourced to a different part. There's this campus apparently there's this part of campus that is very unused, and some people called in favors for it, etc. So they're going there because of the blizzard, and they figure out the, like, switch off with the AFR. So, yeah, the kids are not there, the AFR are. So, first off, Otis P. Lord has recovered. Thank goodness. I don't know why he's, you know, honestly, it's my favorite characters. Lyle, Otis P. Lord, Pat Montesian. Lord has recovered. He's a champ. He's obviously not playing today, but I just wanted to put that out there in our last episode. Finally, we get some resolution on that. Also, Potrancourt is AWOL for some reason, and I'm wondering, did she have a role in this interrogation thing with Joelle Van Dyne, or what else is she doing? That's the question for you avid commenters out there. Also, Wayne is messing around with a quarter on his knuckles and playing Joni Mitchell, which I feel is amazing. I think, I love Joni Mitchell. She's just wonderful. And she's also Canadian, so, you know, it's sort of, it goes along with the expat thing that he's talking about, and it's a very interesting portrait of Wayne at the end of this novel. Hal is also, he's getting his ankle tied up, or taped up, or whatever, and he is just not, he's saying things that are weird, he's, like, looking around, very interesting. It's possible, this is from the Schwartz spoiler thing, it's possible that Hal goes to the emergency room before the match, so he doesn't even get to play today. But that also means that he misses out on the AFR fiasco. And that was from a clue in the beginning of the novel that said that he hadn't been to the ER in almost a year, which is actually around this time. Also, we get Loach's whole backstory, okay? So Loach is the youngest in a big Roman Catholic family, and his mother wanted someone in the family to be a priest in the Roman Catholic Church. So his second oldest, like, his brother that's just older than him, there's, like, 10 of them. All of them have, you know, things that discredit them or don't allow them to be part of the Roman Catholic Church. And so he's got one brother in front of him left, and he's going to be a priest. And so the brother is having a spiritual existential crisis, and he's saying, okay, everyone is so individually wrapped up that I just don't think that this religion thing is working out. So Loach makes a bet with his brother, and he pauses his athletic academics studies stuff at Boston College, and he says, look, I'm gonna be a, like, hermit on the streets, and I'm just gonna ask people to touch me, and I'm gonna try to find someone that will touch me. And so 9 months go by, right? And Loach, like, he's trying to save his own athletic career, basically, because he needs this brother to go into the church so that he can do his athletic stuff with taping, which is what he really wants to do, and what he ends up doing, indeed. So after 9 months of this, Mario Incandenza comes along. He's like 14 years old or something at this point, and he touches, like, all the beggars down the line. And yeah, it's just sort of this really great image that I got. It's very cinematic, almost very dramatic as well. And that's, and you know, after a series of circumstances, Loach gets employed at ETA. Next thread is, second to last thread, you guys, oh my gosh. Okay, next thread is that there's a big glass over Oren. Say hello to my cat. There's a big glass over Oren, and at first, you know, I was like, why is Jim our narrator? Who knows? I'm gonna delve into narrator soon. who knows why? I don't know. I really thought that it was a cockroach at first, because we know that Oren puts cockroaches under glasses to asphyxiate them in his bathroom. And I was just thinking, like, why would the narrator, whoever it is, like, I don't know if it's Jim. I need to look at it really critically at this point. But yeah, why is Jim, or whoever the narrator is, referring to Oren as, or to the cockroach as he? And then I realized that it's, like, Oren in a huge, like, human-sized glass. He's being tortured by the AFR, and they're trying to get out where the master cartridge is buried with himself, of course. And we know that Orin lives, so that's good. They start releasing these cockroaches into the glass. I think that's when Orin probably caves, but who knows? Orin lives, so he definitely give the AFR some sort of information. And here's the theory from Schwartz's article that I believe. I think it's really well supported. The theory is that Orin already stole the master from himself's grave, and he's been giving copies out to himself's enemies. So different people who, for example, the guy that Gately murdered, I'm blanking on his name for some reason, and who was like Avril's lover, it was mentioned in the text, and I did say this on an episode. You guys can go back and trust my word for it, because I did like point this out. I thought it was really interesting, that he probably got it from Orin. And there was a question of like, why does Orin have infinite jest and is like sending it to people? And it may be because he's sort of fulfilling himself's personal agenda in some ways, which I find to be really interesting, and again, a product of the influence of himself over this whole novel. Like, narrator or not, himself is imbued in every single narrative and in every single, almost every single person, it seems like. It's really cool. Last thread here, though. Gately has a bad infection. He's in the hospital. He sees the ADA crying. So there's something that's a little bit tense there. You know, you kind of feel it. And you know there's going to be some resolution, or at least I hope there is. And then we're on the floor of the luxury apartment again. C, and so the guy who replaced Gately with Sorkin's violence business. C and about 10 other people. Like, there's a very homely librarian looking kind of lady. There's a pharmacist that has really bad eczema, it seems like. There's three transvestites in red leather jackets. There's two people who are described as Oriental in the novel. Again, a product of Gately's limited and sort of racist viewpoint. Not sort of, it is racist. So there's like 10 people that come into the apartment with C, and Fax is getting it. Fax is gonna die. And so they have this like gross track of Mrs. McCartney's backups on cymbals and voice playing in the background, as in Mrs. McCartney, like Paul McCartney. It's bad. And so it's just like her terrible voice and some random cymbal crashes. And then there's also an image of Sorkin on the TP with him in like extreme pain, because he did that for a headache commercial. We know he has this neural disease where he gets a lot of pain and his face gets all twisted up. So, I mean, honestly, it fits. And so, Fax, they give him, first of all, they give him something to counteract all of the drugs that he's been taking for the last probably 4 or 5 days, it seems like. And then they start sewing Fax's eyes open. We just know that death is coming for this guy. Poor Fax. And then they give Gately this drug called Sunshine, which is really illicit and elusive. It's a Canadian drug, and it's something that Gately has never tried before, and it has effects similar almost to DMZ. I mean, I'm not a drug expert, you guys. You guys can look at the footnotes and endnotes for that. But yeah, it seems almost like this hyper-focus thing that Hal was getting earlier. It's not DMZ, of course. It's a different drug, but there are connections. And I'm going to read the last line of Infinite Jest for you guys. I figure what better way to end this series than with the last line of this spectacular piece of literature. Quote, page 981. And when he came back to, he was flat on his back on the beach in the freezing sand, and it was raining out of a low sky, and the tide was way out. You guys, we finished Infinite Jest in 8 months. We did it. Congratulations to all of you who read the book along with me. Congrats to all of you who have been following along with the series. My book is torn up and dirty and stuff. I'm going to post pictures of it on the blog if you guys want to look at it after all my annotation and all my traveling with it and everything. And I am ecstatic, you guys. Thank you so, so much for coming along with me, and I will see you in the comments. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.